And welcome once more to Back to the Future, the Zoomcast and podcast that puts those once and future predictions we've collectively made under the hindsight spotlight. My name is Martin Raymond, and this week I'm joined by Kat Tully, the founder of the School of International Futures. Kat, you're very welcome.
Well, it's lovely to be with you. Thanks very much for the invitation, Martin.
You know, a pleasure. And, we were just laughing there because I know with the recording, as we were starting, you had lots of things going on in the background and you were suddenly going, I need to do this. I need to think about that. I must check out my alternatives. And I realized that in some ways, that's what good futurists do. So we're going to be chatting about that in the show. But before that, just I wanted to give listeners a flavor of just some of the things you have done. So you've worked at the strategy unit in Downing Street under Tony Blair and I guess Gordon Brown briefly, and continue to work globally with governments, NGOs and policymakers, helping them to use, as you put it, strategic foresight to better inform their future thinking. Now, can you just tell me a bit more about how that works for listeners who are really used, I guess, in the world of business rather than the world of governments?
Well, a couple of the projects that I was working in the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit was around the future of apprenticeships. How do you actually enable apprentices to be better fit for the future of work? How do you support businesses to actually enable that? Or, for example, the future of prisons and criminal reform. We also looked at the future of social cohesion, what was happening around identities and ethnic divisions and religious divisions in society. But then in the Foreign Office, I was also sometimes looking at how do we start preparing for a future where the Arctic ice is melting? So in all these kind of questions, they're quite broad issues, and you're looking at the fact that the policies that you're making today need to be looking at what the issue is going to be like in the future.
Okay, so I was thinking about, if you think about business leaders, a lot of them are looking for solutions around a product or a strategy. And really, one of the reasons I was keen to chat to you particularly is that suddenly when you get into the world of, you know, political scenarios, social, global, there are hugely different questions that people need to both ask, but also, I guess, the scenarios and the alternatives of this future we're going to be looking at will be based on people rather than products, which must be, in essence, hugely different to just trying to work out what a new vacuum cleaner looks like or your new box of Kellogg's and things like that.
That's right. So in what way is it different? So the traditional answer that I'd have given like 20 years ago is that businesses are environment takers and governments are environment shapers. So they have more agency, and therefore it's important that they work with citizens to mediate and discuss what they want their future to look like. So governments can control things like investment in infrastructure. They can also make policies around things like a nuclear-free world or not, banning slavery, banning inequality, for example. So these are big kind of sets of tools in the government toolkit that are much greater than for businesses. However, I don't think that's necessarily the case so much nowadays, where there are a lot of businesses that are also creating the future. The tech companies come to mind. But I think the big difference is as well is that when you work with politicians, when you're working with business leaders, they've normally come up through the organization. They know the organization really well and their business. Politicians, you know, what's the training for a politician? You know, they will often come into a government and they don't really know the ministry that they're looking after. So that's quite an interesting issue as well.
So I guess you're both educating them in terms of the parameters and frameworks that you will use as a forecaster, but also there is, I guess, an expertise issue which you tend not to find in business. If, let's say, you're dealing with a tech company like Google, for example, you know, people will be invested in that particular business. Where I guess politicians, somebody once said to me, you know, their favorite color, they will always say tartan because they don't wish to offend anybody and don't really wish to make anybody worry about the ability for them to think. And I guess one of the question that always troubles me or makes me curious about when you're looking at political scenarios is how much of what you're doing is done simply to placate the politician or the administrator or whatever, and therefore nothing will happen from it, and how much is done with you deliberately trying to push them to think beyond their initial voter requirements into the future? And if you do, how do you manage to do this? Because I know politicians are quite tricksy people to work with.
Well, I mean, politicians are in the business of mediating between different interests, but they also tend to have a worldview, like on the left or on the right, how things happen, the importance of addressing things like climate change versus growing the economy. So they will come with values that they want to express that you need to embed in your theory of change about how you see the world works. So in your systems map, for example, if you want to drive the economy, do you try to get more women into the workforce, or do you try to reduce taxation on businesses? That will therefore decide the frame of that you're looking at, and then see, well, what are the trends facing businesses? What are the trends facing women in the workplace? So our role is to both take the politician's point of view and actually put it in as factual a system as possible, and to bring in the other drivers that they may not naturally consider or that are priority for their voters, but that there is good evidence to back that up. And I should say that constitutionally, the civil service owns the long term beyond the term of office of the politicians, and so does Parliament. Parliament is a great place to have bipartisan conversations about what the future of the country should look like. Government officials, politicians also are often open to alternative scenarios. And as with all things, it's about very much using the value of scenarios in 10 or 20 years' time and talking about the value of creating a better future for your children. That often gets people opened up versus, you know, this is my manifesto.
I think that's probably the better way to look at it. Because when I work with people, for example, in business, I work, you know, Diageo, Spotify, Microsoft, and there's always an end goal, which is, you know, the product or the category or, you know, opening up a new market's territory. And I always think it's always quite short term. Where if you get into the world of scenarios and I guess, you know, future planning, you can escape the short term and then teach people to look at the long term. So I just wanted you to maybe think for a few moments on how, when you get people to that place where they're no longer thinking about, you know, the next year or whatever, and they're looking at the next 5 or 10 years, what are the things that you think you need to bring to the table or to the planning room, so to speak, to help them see and feel and negotiate their way through this thing much better?
So I used to work for Procter & Gamble. That was my first step.
Worked in the world of business, the dreaded world of business.
And they were making some big bets about where they were investing large factories and production. So they were thinking, you know, 10 to 20 to 30 years out in terms of, you know, where consumer tastes are going, yes, but also geopolitically, where's safe to invest in terms of Eastern Europe, what kind of joint ventures, what kind of products are needed. So in fact, you know, arguably there's quite a lot of long-term thinking from my experience in the business, and it's not that dissimilar. Very often from a government perspective, you're doing three things at the end of the day. You're trying to bring people together to design a desirable future, because that's the role of government, a better outcome for all. And you need to be able to describe that. But at the same time, you also need to be prepared for the risks that will happen. Now, for example, the conflict between Israel and Palestine 20 years ago looked very differently, because over the past 20 years, Palestinian women have been having 6 children each, and Israeli women have had 1.8 children each. So what the population change happens in that time, 20 years later, and in 20 years in the future, drives conflict. So some of these things are predictable, and it's the art of bringing those facts in.
Yeah.
And understanding, for example, that they are linked with other facts to create a situation. Now, if you care about maternal health, for example, and you are trying to do something to achieve the sustainable development goals of reducing maternal mortality at birth, you actually, the best evidence indicates that you need to invest in infrastructure and roads to get you into the hospital rather than in more doctors. So again, it's looking at what are you trying to do and what are the factors that affect it. Yes. And that systems map, the drivers of change, and then the scenarios, and doing that in an exercise which is participative, the desired future, and then backcasting, developing policies and stress testing them, wind tunneling them against the different scenarios. That is the role and the work that we do.
You see, you've used a lot of interesting terms there, you know, in terms of some forecasters will be familiar with wind tunneling, you know, backcasting, a really good one to use, but also the notion of, you know, where you're setting up the I guess, the probable possible and the alternative horizon lines. And I think one of the things, when I met you for the first time, when I was interviewing you for my book, you said a really interesting thing about how these things work, which really, I think you just hit on it there. You said, first of all, it's the input of data. You know, to get the correct modeling, you require data. Expert thinking and experts who are in some ways not looking at the ordinary or the everyday, but looking at the extraordinary. So that point about more children on one side, less children on the other, really alters the potential of the future map. But you also said, crucially, it requires imagination, it requires openness, and the ability to consider a variety of possible, even unpalatable scenarios that public-facing bodies sometimes prefer to shy away from. So just think about the Palestinian-Israeli crisis, think about the Northern Irish one at the moment, what's happening there. So how do you, I guess, you know, going back here, get politicians to think the unthinkable? If they got voters to think about, they've got the, you know, midterms coming up, they've got the fact that you've got maybe two opposing religions that they're having to mollify and deal with. What is your advice to the forecaster who finds himself in a room with these people?
Okay, so I would love to come back to the point about how foresight and conflict come together, because I think that's very powerful stories about how foresight in Zimbabwe, in Venezuela, Colombia, in Israel, Palestine has really made a difference. But let me just perhaps say about, on your point, like, first of all, I think we need to say to people that we are not forecasting. There are some things that are predictions, but actually, especially in the world of complex policymaking, you can't predict. So you are saying that already what you're doing is you're providing a range of options and none of them will be true. Okay. Neither the ones that you desire, neither the one that you fear is going to happen. But the third benefit, which I normally lead with, is the fact that by doing this kind of exercise, you are creating a civil service or an organization that is future prepared. It's open. It's looking to the future rather than looking back. Now, the way that I talk about it is that that there's two sets of skill sets that are necessary. If you want to simplify it extremely basically and poorly, it's left versus right brain. So left brain endeavors is about all the historical modeling, you know, the kind of ICCC modeling of how climate change is going to happen, or the kind of fact that civil servants know very well at how the economy works and how to drive it, for example. That is evidence that you can marshal, and then you can set up systems maps, you can bring out assumptions between your interdependencies, and you can do a lot of analytical work that is testable and fits in very nicely with the concept of policy-based, evidence-based policymaking. That's on the left-hand side. Now, on the right-hand side is something very interesting, which is the fact that at the end of the day, the future is a story that you tell yourself about the present. It's a story either of hope, like look at Black Panther and what that's done to the Black community.
Afrofuturism, it was coined, yeah.
Exactly, so Afrofuturism, for example. So all that stuff, and that's core to politics, because politics is about power, and it's like, who gets to tell the official future? So you tend to have an official future, which, by the way, for example, Saudi has a very official future when it's looking out to 2030.
Yeah.
But how many voices are there involved? And the official future tends to be a used future. It's a future of the people in power today and is actually used as a form of control. And so the important thing, if you are someone who wants to use foresight in a transformative way and in an authentic way to create a new and open up into the future that is going to emerge, rather than talk about the future, but it actually be a reflection of the present. If you want to do that, then you absolutely need to both use creative techniques and use different people and listen to alternative voices. And alternative voices and citizens are not going to understand trends and charts. They need to use different methods, whether it's theater, whether it's expression, whether it's modeling. So that is why you need to have the two.
To do, and I guess, you know, the powerful nature of the story, because if you think about something like, you know, Black Panther, for example, Wonder Woman, 1984, not the new version of it. Again, you know, we're so used, I guess, in forecasts about the hero's journey, you know, the male view of how the future will look. And then you have this, well, I think it was Maureen, one of the students of the original guy, Joseph Campbell, who created the heroine's journey. She said, what about the hero's journey? What about the heroine? What about the women in this tale? And increasingly we're saying, what about, you know, people of global majority? What about trans? What about non-binary? And I think out of that, probably then listeners get a good idea of how the future is, that sort of fermentation of ideas, people, things that are put into the cooking pot of the future, so to speak, to keep my muddled metaphor going. And then you're boiling up and hoping to distill some of those things that I think you were beginning to talk about. And I kind of feel that everybody believes in the data part, and everybody believes in the science and the modeling. And increasingly, you know, we're talking about using AI to help us with these particular systems. But I'm just wondering how much the human story it's almost failed to be captured in that. And, you know, what you're saying about theatre, the imagination, using different ways to move forward. Is this something, for example, that governments are comfortable with? You know, politicians, the work you're doing in Africa, will you be using all of these different techniques? Or do you find yourself resorting back to the data? Because that's really what people are used to trusting, and therefore they feel that's all they need to do to plan these futures.
I can take this in so many different ways.
Exactly what you need, because I'm really curious in that a lot of people listening will have a very stringent view of how, you know, strategic forecasting works, how, you know, the nature of future studies, trend audits and something like that. And I know that you use some, but also you use things differently. And that's really what I'm trying to extract today, is those differences that I know make your work so exceptional.
Okay, so I would never describe myself as a futurist, because I see futurists as supplying insight about the future. Okay, so it's a supply-led thing. What I would describe the endeavor that we do, that is perhaps strategic foresight or emergent strategic planning, is helping organizations and decision makers and communities use those insights to make better decisions today, and how they actually create the organization's institutional capacity to act on them. So that's very different. You know, why else be in this game unless you want to bloody create impact? You know,
yeah.
Kodak identified and drove a lot of the changes that basically drove it out of business, but wasn't able to act on it. Konica Minolta did. So what's the point if you're not connecting it into the act?
Perfect.
Action? So we are actually very, very tool agnostic, but what we are very clear about is what the process is that we follow. And so we have a four-stage process, which is effectively a human-centered design decision support scaffolding to help you as a futurist think through what are the tools that you need, what is the scope of the question that you're looking at. If you're working for Toyota, are you looking at the future of car, or are you looking at the future of mobility? Now, you'll do the car if your time horizon is 2 and 5 years out. But if you are a company that has been around for 100 years, you may want to kind of say, let's get out of this business. You know, if you, and in fact, there's some fantastic, there's a great Dutch company that moved from kind of agricultural chemical hydrocarbons all the way to kind of vitamins and did that transition over 5 to 10 years because of that time horizon that they saw themselves. So that aid of decision-making both is important at the beginning to understand what you're trying to do, and also at the end when you're trying to communicate it. Now, what happens in the middle is a lot of different analytical tools that you use to kind of identify insights and get signals and identify what to do, okay? And they, you will engage, you will use quantitative data, you will use qualitative data by working with humans to get their amazing insights in the ways that are appropriate for them. But then you get to the end and then you need to communicate it to have impact. And that is when it needs to be different depending on the audience. Now, there's a great story that the UK government did this flooding work out to 2080, talking about the impact of climate change. Now, the problem is, as soon as you talk about 2080, decision makers turn off. It's like, what can I do?
Yeah.
Now, what was powerful was that they pulled together a map of the UK by member of parliament constituencies, and they were like red, yellow, green. So a member of parliament, the kind of level of engagement that they got from the MPs was transformational, because they were like, okay, I'm going to look at where my constituency is. So get what the insights are, understand what you want people to do about it, and then communicate it in a way that is respectful and connects into the audience. I mean, none of it is rocket science.
Yeah, but
it isn't the design of the whole process.
Yeah, you say it isn't, but so many get it wrong. And what I quite like about the techniques and methods you've described is how much it brings things back to realities that people can grapple with. So that, you know, if I have this map of, you know, 2080 or 2030, well, I may be dead by then, so I don't really need to think about it. So how do I bring it back to the now? And you know, the flood barriers falling, land being eroded, the damage that will do to my locality, you know, my parks, etc. Suddenly the story becomes alive. And I think, you know, a lot of futurists, to use that term that I know you, in fact, I had a quote here from you saying that you would never call yourself a futurist or a forecaster for that reason. And mainly, and I think maybe this is also the case, that when you use it, a lot of people either see it as you know, wild future gazing about either dystopian or utopian cities, or they see it as a bit like, well, I remember once going into Miami, I mean, stopped by security, and they said, so what do you do and why are you here? And I said, well, I'm a futurist. And this woman stepped back and said, could you do it now for me? And I realized she wanted me to read her palm. And I kind of go, in some ways, that's what happens, that we use terms that people misread, misunderstand, and therefore misappropriate. So I think what you've described is a language that I'm now going to use, and I'm hoping that listeners will understand why you're shying away from those terms, for example. I think you've also taught me how to look structurally at a forecast and to bring it back to the reality of people and places. So there is a direct link between the now, the next, and the far future. And just, you know, kind of to finish up this section, what do you think are the other watch outs for people who are going, okay, I've got these things at my disposal, but what are the things that you think hide or lurk in the shadows that come out to bite the unwary strategic forecaster, or dare I use that word, futurist?
Well, my advice would be always think about the people and the institutions that are going to use your insight. So is it an investment decision? Are they trying to stress test portfolios? Is it a recruitment decision? Is it a policy decision? Is it about developing an idea to work with another country? So shape what you're doing in your analysis around the purpose, and that will actually help your long-term, medium-term, short-term all congruent
together, right.
I also think that there's something really interesting about the importance of engaging with the communities. So, you know, and understanding that what might feel like a long-term horizon for you, 2030, 2050, isn't for an 18-year-old. We just did something on the future of Mozambique 2030. You know, although we're looking 10 years ahead, the reason why people were doing it is because they were rebuilding after the cyclone Idai. But the question is, do you rebuild what there was before, or do you actually have a much longer vision? And that vision has to be informed by women. It has to be informed by the fact that half of the population in Mozambique are under the age of 20.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are going to live with it. Final example, did something on the future of higher education in Malaysia. Now, you bring lots of academics into the room to discuss that. Now, an 18-year-old in 2030 is actually Generation Alpha, born in 2011. Yeah. They have incredibly different perspectives and expectations of how to learn and what they want to do than even Generation Z, let alone millennials. We haven't even got our heads around how to prepare for them. So we talk about it being the future, but just as 200 years ago is actually your grandparents' grandparents and ditto going forward, these concepts of time you can play with and thicken the now. And I think that's what our job is with decision-making, is to thicken that now.
Yeah, I guess you're talking about that, fairly kind of old concept about cathedral thinking. You know, if you think about the first cathedrals in Europe when they were built, or the great mosques in the East, you know, that they took three generations to complete. And the person who started, who laid the first stone or dug the first sod, would never see this thing finish in not their lifetime, but their grandchildren's lifetime, potentially the great-great-grandchildren. And yet they were built, and they've stood the extraordinary test of time. And when you look at how they were built, it was through stories. A lot of the time, even the plans weren't written down. They were drawn in the sand. They were described. They were shown in fragmentary forms. And yet everybody could take that story, buy into it, and move forward and create those beautiful buildings. And I guess with good foresight or forecasting, that this is what we're trying to teach people. And one thing I read about cathedral thinking, which I thought was quite fascinating, they said at the time when people were setting out on this journey, they didn't really believe or could conceive that the world would change radically in 100 years. So if you're in a medieval town in France or Germany or Italy or whatever, you weren't sitting there thinking, gosh, in 150 years time, we will have X or Y. You just assumed that the continuity would be as it was now. And then somebody said, but if you look at it now, we are so used to thinking that change is not just inevitable, it'll be swift and so different that we give up on the future in some ways because you think it's going to exhaust us. You know, we couldn't sit there and think, well, let's plan this great building for 150 years time because we'd have climate change, we'd have technology differences, we'd have geopolitical storms, et cetera, et cetera. And they said that in some ways, our understanding and our knowledge and assumptions about tomorrow have exhausted us into inactivity. So I'm just wondering if you feel that's the case, or is that me just being pessimistic and Irish when I kind of think about why we give up so easily on tomorrow?
So Alvin Toffler's future shock, the fact that change is happening so much that you're paralyzed in the face of it.
That's me.
Is a very helpful way to kind of engage and it's a lens into human behavior. I'm not quite sure that it's the case, you know, the population in medieval Europe actually plunged by 70% over 100 years because of the Black Death. So there was a huge amount of turbulence and sophistication there as well. I'm never necessarily convinced by arguments that say that the rate of change is increasing, although I certainly agree that our ability to scan and see and absorb information has massively gone up. But this is back to the kind of core factor, you know, the cathedral thinking and this paralysis is back to what does 21st century leadership mean in a world where, you know, for the past 200 years, because of the capitalist system and a focus on producing and short-term results and outputs, you've basically ended up just having a very quite short-term perspective. Now, what does it mean to lead and to be a steward, not just for now, but for future generations? And how do you do that? And I think that's both in businesses, increasingly boards are recognizing that that's their role, that they need to realize the costs and the benefits accrued to societies and to communities outside their narrow boundary, but also in the future. But also, governments increasingly are realizing that representative democracy and other forms of democracy aren't working so well. What's the role of not doing command and control, but perhaps using this lodestar, this image of that you in the sand, the fact that you kind of say, this is the aspirational future that we want to go to, and this is how we as a community move towards it. Which is why the quote I always use is that the act of a community coming together to collaboratively discuss their own futures is a deeply politically empowering one. It's about taking power from the people who have it and giving it to the people who need voice. And that gives agency and certainty and support and confidence in a very uncertain world.
See, I find that fascinating, because when I hear people, particularly in Britain, and this was something, I guess, before Brexit, I felt British people hugely disinterested in politics, but hugely involved in community. And I always found it odd that they distinguished between one and the other. You know, coming from Ireland, where you were, I guess, taught civic studies at an early age, you understood that civic or community was all about politics and all about, you know, the local and the national level. And I really felt that, that it was interesting that here people had split it. But I'm beginning to see now, you know, as the political landscape changes, we're potentially looking at, you know, this four nation federated thinking, that suddenly we're all just not energized about the potential, but we're all asking about the end game, as in what could it look like, you know, the super regions, the super mayors, the fact that, you know, we may have countries that are part of our geography, but completely distinct and different in character, and that should be celebrated. And that to me is, I guess, the essence of good, you know, forward planning and forecasting, that we look at what these things could be, but then we act, as you say, locally and collaboratively to generate and make these things possible. But does that, to go back to my point about, you know, imagination, does that not just require imagination, but permission to use it? Because I think a lot of the things we have legislated against and removed from our modeling processes is what I call the adjective of possibility. You know, a sentence requires a fact and an adjective, and everybody loves a fact, but we are wary of adjectives. And I always think in kind of forecasting and strategic planning, imagination plays or should play a more relevant and cogent part than potentially it does at the moment.
Well, that's absolutely true. But the imagination is out there. The question is, why is that imagination and those ideas not getting to the decision makers?
Yeah.
That's for me, and this is where futures analysis and ways of thinking, which is like how change happens over time, whether it's S-curve technology, whether it's generational like conflict, many genocides happen every 30 years because of, you know, or early adopters, you know, what's the shape of change and how does that all interlock with each other? And as Andrew Curry, my great director of futures, says, quoting Graham Molitor, you know, trends play out over kind of 50 to 80 years. And you can kind of spot when the disruptions are happening. And that happens with ideas and paradigms. So we are going through, as he says, through probably a big shift now about macroeconomic theory and the role of the state in the economy that has been in place and it's been dogma for the past 40 years. And there's a shift now. And so the way that change happens, I think, you know, what the saying is, never lose a good crisis. You know, things are stuck and the paradigm and infrastructure, Horizon One, is stuck. But there are people, the weak signals of Horizon Two and early indicators of Horizon Three, who are imagining a different future the whole time around you. They just can, you know, and the question is, at the moment of crisis when things are malleable, can you bring those voices to create change? And that's, I think, the really interesting thing that's happening in the, you know, the hydrocarbon to the green economy transformation conversation now, but also the scary thing is that you look at the positive moves, but you don't see the negative moves, which is the scary, concerning building through the pandemic of underlying drivers of gross inequality and redistribution from poor to rich that will then cause, if we're not careful, a very painful next two decades, like the last decade, you know, that makes that pale into significance. So this is how we can marshal, you know, our knowledge of how time and fluctuation changes and feed it into policymakers and decision makers whilst listening to the ideas of the community. Now, the language we use is never going to connect with neither policymakers nor it's so esoteric, but we can change and we can listen and we can bring interesting ideas.
To do, I think you've already started doing that. I was kind of curious about, if you go back to you know the foundation of the School of International Futures, think about that. To me, it was quite an academic undertaking, and I always think that academia has a lot to teach us about, you know, the structural processes, the way we think. So teaching us how to think, how to unlock imagination, but also, I guess, how to build bridges and opportunities in areas where previously they A, didn't exist, or people perhaps in B, didn't believe they needed them to exist. So academia, I was thinking, is kind of out there doing the job that a lot of people are not doing. How much of yourself when you founded it was thinking that in terms of, you know, I'll create this thing with more rigor to it? Or how much of you was just saying, actually, there is a time needed to think about the future in a different way? Or what were you trying to do when you set up the original school? Where did you found it, actually? Where did you kind of started from?
It was here in the UK. I left government in 2010. And that point that we're saying, there's no lack of insight about the future. What there is a demand side issue. So how do you enable and bring those insights to enable the transmission, the integration, the translation? It's that we're focusing on. And there's two, I think the word school really brings up two concepts that I think are very powerful here. School is a community who, it's a field of trying to kind of bring people together to change. And I think it's also bringing, in terms of that community, ensuring that we actually look at the next generation and think about how we scale up for impact. Now, if you look at all straight line projections, the world is going to start falling off a cliff ecologically in terms of planetary boundaries fairly soon. There's a tipping point that we're getting literally within the next 5 to 10 years that is irreversible in terms of damage. So, and I profoundly believe, and this is why part of the vision behind the school is that strategic foresight and the ability to understand intergenerational fairness, to think about how your decisions today affect the future, is a profound skill that needs to be democratized, that needs to be taken into schools, needs to be taken into businesses, civil society, and governments, because it's how we can make decisions effectively and fairly in an uncertain world. And therefore, this idea of scaling up and taking, crystallizing what the key concepts and principles are, and then sharing it around the world is part of why we've set up as a school, if you like. The final thing I'll say is that we have therefore focused quite a lot over the last 3 years on setting up a network called the Next Generation Foresight Practitioners, because although I'm obviously 29, I'm not as young as I was, and I'm definitely not Horizon 2 or Horizon 3. Yeah. I went to Cambridge University. I worked in the centre of government. I'm as conservative, relatively conservative as you get. So I'm not the sign of the future, but what I can do is we can act as a bridge to get the amazing ideas of next generation foresight practitioners, especially in the global south, who are fantastic change agents. They're recreating the school of the future, like Raya is doing, 24-year-old Iranian in Dubai, 21-year-old Namatai in Zimbabwe is, you know, creating a youth movement and saying, what kind of future Zimbabwe do we want? These are the kind of people that need to be listened to. And if we can act as a translator to enable their ideas of their future to work up by decision makers today, that's our job done.
I guess it is about, could you use that term, you know, intergenerational, I guess not just conflicts, but that dialogue. And I guess the worry of those in power about allowing other people to create the future is that it will preclude them, you know, to rule them out. And the great complaints of the young is that they are not being considered in these futures. So I think that's a tension that always exists. But your proposal is, I think, you know, you're bringing the voices together, and I guess allowing them through the academic medium, particularly through the school, to not just give voice, but teach them how to use voice, which I think is equally important, that, you know, you show people how to use it is far better than telling them that the thing could look like this. Is there a kind of a third way where you take all of these things and then put it back to the general public? Because I always think that, you know, academia is still in some ways feared and suspected by people that, you know, as an academic, people always say to me, what's your real job? As if somehow being an academic isn't a real job. And when I work in business, when I say to business people, you know, I do work as an academic, they're quite impressed by that, because I always feel that their jobs aren't real. They're somehow bogusly making money and they need legitimacy. So I'm just wondering with the school as well, has that provided you with a legitimacy in one area or in another? Or do you think it's just giving you time to think about the world differently?
Yeah, it gives us time to think, and it also enables us to spend a lot of our time on thought leadership and action research. So we will identify issues that are coming up and actually work hard on them, even though we're not being paid to do that. That's the real, it's an agenda for research. So, you know, futures techniques from around the world, you know, these next generation foresight practitioners, they're innovating. They're not just looking at interesting issues. They're also using and developing new methods, like the Carver method that our first main award winner, Pupul Bisht, developed based on a kind of religious cycle in India. It's like, that's how you go with the untouchable communities and you take them through a conversation about their future. That's amazing. So we can spend time thinking about things like that, thinking about new issues like how do you examine intergenerational fairness in a world of COVID, where on the one hand, there's huge amounts of potential conflict. You know, the young are being asked to stay in for the old. They're also going to incur huge amounts of debt given the massive infrastructure, but there's also an opportunity to kind of build the future for them as well. Green economy, technological disruption. So there's potential for conflict, but at the same time, never have we seen so much intergenerational solidarity.
Yeah, and sharing. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting that the way you're looking at the future, because I always think quite a lot of the guests I've had have a fairly, not a linear view, but it's a fairly, you know, the future is this, there are a couple of options, and if you follow this, you get it right. And I feel that your thesis and understanding of the future is about, you know, people, the collective voice, collaborations, also having the vision that sits at the end of it. You then have quite a clear set of tools, which I think is unusual. You know, I was speaking to somebody from McKinsey, what I call, you know, the Borg of consultancies. And they had a lot of tools which suited their view of the world. And I was thinking afterwards, what was missing was empathy. And the thing that I think you've hit on, without using that word, is to understand the future and to forecast or to help people get to it, we need to be empathic with each other and also about the potentials and the dangers that sit in the future. So can you just talk me through your thinking on a word or a feeling or an idea like empathy?
I think the word empathy comes with the word respect and the word active listening. And I think that's actually absolutely key skill for us and the work that we do. The signals of change and the future are out there. You know, as the Molitor quote, these trends take 50 to 70 years. So they're already around you. Who are you listening to? Which is why at the end of the day, this is quite a subversive activity, because what you're doing is you're maximizing your ability to listen to people at the periphery. And so to your point about, you know, you were comparing how I'm talking about foresight with perhaps others, you know, that I think, so you mentioned beforehand that you were asked whether you were a palm reader or a crystal.
Yes, it was that where I, pardon me, it was a bit like where you're, you know, people are suspicious of what you do, but actually it occurred to me that what that wasn't just quite intimate. It was about where palm readers, by their craft or skill, are empathic. That's exactly what they do. Isn't it? That's what they're doing. That's why we trust them. We trust them to help us because we see them being empathetic to our particular situation.
So Riel always talks about, you know, divination, entrail, looking at as being another form. It needs to be at least accepted in the field. And I think although people snigger and say we're not crystal ball gazers, what's important is your point about cathedral thinking and the narrative and the picture. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, the future, you can see that the future is a shiny ball, a positivist shiny ball that's out there that you can measure with calipers and shine and look at as an object, or you can see the endeavor of what we're doing as looking in a mirror and trying to polish and get a better understanding.
Clearer vision. I don't know if you use the Delphi method, but, you know, even the title, you know, the Oracle of Delphi gives us a clue as to the nature of these, you know, attempts at forecasting, which are not about divination in terms of how it was understood historically, but using the same tools and techniques, you know, the listening, the inviting in, the testing, the challenging, the throwing out of an idea, and then suddenly it crystallizes into an opportunistic or potential moment that we can all move forward into. And that kind of, I think, is not just how good forecasting works. And historically, you know, when you read people like, you know, Wendell Bell talking about how we looked at it through the ages, there was a lot of science in that art of, you know, seeing into the future and future gazing. But what I also wanted to talk about, because we've reached that midpoint in the show, dare I say, because it's just kind of coming at us really quickly, is part of what we do here is also reflect on a forecast or a scenario that we've got wrong. You know, I kind of, my classic one was that I forecast clearly that Boris would close the country in January of last year, and also that we would have lockdown afterwards, and at the end of that we will be clear of this terrible thing. And obviously I call that so wrong and so incorrectly. I had to go around and eat humble pie for a week. So was there something that you kind of did and you go afterwards, wow, that wasn't the case? Because then that takes me to my next question, but your forecast first before we go further.
So we were in Angola doing a set of scenarios, and actually we're doing some kind of like, and we were literally in the middle of the workshop. We developed the scenarios for a long time. You know, the whole thing about Angola is that it had an incumbent president that was never going to let go. And then literally in the middle of the workshop, as we're having these kind of role plays, we heard that the president, Dos Santos, had said that he was going to step down in a year, which he actually ended up doing. So that was a bit like, oh. But then that's a great point, because it's like, this, ladies and gentlemen, is why you need to do strategic foresight, because things that you think are impossible actually do happen. Another funny story there is, so in the Foreign Office, and this is all now outside of the 30-year rule, I think there was a great policy planning paper in 1987 by the head of Policy Planner, who was like, hold on to your horses, ladies and gentlemen. We actually believe that the Berlin Wall may fall in 30 years' time.
Wow.
So, you know, this is again what we're trying to do. She knew her audience.
Yeah.
What she's trying to do is put an unpalatable or unthinkable fact, and she plays with the timeline.
To give them the benefit of being able to grasp it.
The weak signals, it's going to happen much quicker.
Yeah, I find that fascinating, because it really is what I guess a lot of us will do when we're forecasting, is having the unpalatable, you know, kind of scenario or possibility. I mean, there was a great piece in after the 9/11 attacks and fall of the Twin Towers. There was a government oversight committee in the US where they, you know, a phrase jumped out and said it didn't happen because of terrorism. It didn't happen because of geopolitical conflicts. It happened because of a failure of the imagination. Yeah. These things were not just talked about.
Challenging assumptions. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's, I think, is where, I guess, when I talk about failure, that's really what I'm talking about, is where we learn from that to push forward. And we're thinking about, actually, if next time we're doing this, you know, we really will embrace the unthinkable and the unpalatable. So just kind of taking those ideas there, what have you now built into your structural systems to allow these things to be more seamlessly introduced to potentially those clients who are not really keen to think the unthinkable?
So we talk about foresight governance and the ecosystem that you need as a senior leader to build the ability amongst your staff to think about the future and to scan. So we turn it into a technocratic exercise. And so that really helps. And you bring examples from different, you know, from different countries and different sectors. But it is a capability that is needed. And, you know, like you can take the global financial crisis. There's so many examples. It's like, and, you know, many people have talked about this phenomenon and, you know, whether it's super forecasters and all this kind of stuff that's got bling around.
It's very black swan principle. Yeah.
I mean, Isaiah Berlin talked about you know, people are either foxes or hedgehogs. And hedgehogs have got a way of seeing the world, it's a model, that means that they discount other phenomenon. Okay, and what we're trying to do is try to help people be a little bit more foxes, you know, let go a little bit of your model of the world and actually see the signals for what they are, and we can help you do that.
And I guess being hyper alert, I mean, one of the things is that a lot of times when I'm working more, particularly in corporate culture, they say, oh, thanks for those trends, we're not going to work with them. And I say, hang on a minute, it's like a weather system, it's ever changing, and there are new systems ever incoming. And if you said that you were a pilot of a plane and you had the weather forecast from yesterday and you thought, well, I'm going to set off flying, we wouldn't trust you in a plane. And yet that's what CEOs are effectively doing. You know, he, she, they want to know one thing that will help them, and that's it. And I go, look, it's like you are like a pilot. You know, she is in the air and she's looking around and she's seeing these incoming systems. I'm going, my gosh, I've got to do this, adjust that, you know, lift my aviators, whatever. And suddenly that's what flying is about. And I always think that the future is really that weather system that we're flying into. And what you're giving them is a set of instruments and tools and co-pilots, passengers also, who are able and aware, that what I call the hyper-vigilance of opportunity, the fox. You know, you're thinking about the future. So on that note, because I'm kind of just aware of our time here, just a couple of thoughts from you on what you think, with your hypervigilant hat on, what do you think are the big issues we will need to think about over the next decade or 20 or 30 years? Just you know, one or two, do you think this is what we now should be focusing on?
So I think that there, let's share three issues. I think we need to keep an eye on intergenerational fairness, and how we rebuild after COVID in a way that means that we don't colonize the future, we don't push costs into the future and support the current dirty industries, for example, hydrocarbon industries. That's equally the case for equality across countries and within countries, by the way. I think, you know, there's a real danger if we digitalize and go make some big bets on AI without an awareness of how that drives inequality in society because of jobs and other factors,
we
end up with very huge problems. So that's one thing. The other factor, I think, is how the decarbonisation of the economy, so the move from a hydrocarbon to a green economy, how that intersects. So that's a good thing in terms of governance and stability, reduces the returns to corruption in all sorts of very unstable and fragile states around the world. But at the same time, you've got climate change basically reducing sustainable livelihoods and probably driving rural to urban migration at a time in many countries where there's a very high youth population. So that's that, how the timelines intersect is a really, really interesting question, and uncertainty that are going to, you know, it's going to play out geopolitically, economically, hugely. So those are two big things.
I think that's the big one
is Africa. Sorry.
Yeah, no, sorry. I was going to ask you about Africa, because I think it's almost like, in some ways, yet again, the forgotten continent. You know, we see it as an entity rather than that vast number of countries, some 35 of which are living, you know, close to the high end of incomes and opportunities. And then like Europe, you have other parts of it that are just missing off the map. So if you've kind of cast your mind, because I know you've been doing a lot of work, you know, with different African states at the moment, what are the things that you would actually, let's do a forecast about Africa. You know, we've talked about Black Panther earlier. So look at Africa and give me a number of forecasts that I can test you against when I meet you in 10
years. I don't do forecasts, as you know.
Okay, sorry. I thought I could slip that in there. Okay. So let me imagine a scenario or a set of alternative futures that you would like to see, you know.
We've done some interesting work looking at conflict in Mozambique. And I think, unfortunately, some countries may well be, because of climate change and repeated cyclones, a bit like in the Caribbean, you know, either we're going to have to go in a big way to kind of drive reconstruction and development, or they're going to have to be totally failed states. I mean, it's just really shocking if you look at the trajectory over 15 years. However, at the same time, you've got this amazing growth and potential in the youth bulge that's in Africa. And that's what I think the center of gravity is absolutely going to start moving towards Africa. I think the Africa-China relationship, is it a new form of colonization in terms of like extracting primary commodities, or is it actually slightly different? very different is a real question.
Yeah, I think is it symbiotic or parasitic?
Correct.
I think that's the phrase used, I think, in recent issue of Foreign Affairs. And I think that's the debate we're having, you know, which way will it play out? And in fact, I guess scenarios like the ones you're discussing will help it play out or be better understood by people on the ground as to how it could potentially be. I just have a couple of things. At this point, I try to do my predictions, okay, which are never, in fact, I'm not even going to attempt to get close to you because mine are always slightly scurrilous and in some ways, you know, potentially challengeable. But I just wanted to give you three as I give all of my guests and ask you to tell me which one you think is most likely and which one you think is least likely and which one you think is, well, Martin, that's bizarre. And I don't even know why you're thinking that. So my first one is, I'm going to predict the breakup of the union and the rise of four-nation federalism within 5 years. So that's my prediction one. Do you think that's true or false?
I don't think it's going to happen within 5 years.
Okay, let me go to my next one. Mm-hmm. I'm also predicting that Katie Price, you know, will become an emergency responder and surprise us all with her down-to-earth pragmatism.
No, I think that's not an unfair possibility. Yes, I'm going to say...
Okay, so let me give you the third one. Oh, okay, right. I'm finally predicting that Elon Musk will crash land on Mars, never to bother us again within 20 years.
I'm going to say yes.
Right, you know, this is why I'm amazing. Don't call yourself a forecaster because you called it right on Katie Price. She will become an emergency responder. I can tell you this because I know that her TV program about the subject is about to be put on air. I think the Four Nations Federalism, I've predicted within 5 years, but I'm willing to give it 10. I think it will happen.
I would totally that. I just don't see the legislative and constitutional path to it happening in 5 years, basically.
Exactly. Yes. And then, you know, the Elon Musk thing, look, you know, he said he'd love to crash on Mars and not want to die there, but I'm kind of not sure if I'd agree with the second one either. I'm a bit of an annoying person. But it is interesting that we are already, and this is, I guess, you know, the point I wanted to leave us with is that we're already looking out and up, where I think the last decade we spent a lot of time looking down and in. So that, you know, the future isn't just bright, I think opportunistic in a way that a lot of us, forecasters, strategic foresight individuals, people thinking about tomorrow are beginning to consider. And I just want to thank you for joining me and sharing your thoughts today. And just to remind people that they can find out more about your work at your School of International Futures Studies Guide at, is it SWAF? Do you pronounce it SWAF?
That's right, SWAF, www.swaf.org.uk.
Okay, perfect. And I'm looking forward to chatting again, but until we all meet, so let's keep listening, keep looking, keep learning and asking, well, what's new and what's next about tomorrow?